Welcome to the Scrum.org Community Podcast, a podcast from the home of Scrum. In this podcast, we feature professional Scrum trainers and other Scrum practitioners sharing their stories and experiences to help learn from the experience of others. This episode is a previous recording of our live Ask a Professional Scrum Trainer series, where a live audience asks questions of professional Scrum trainers. We hope you enjoy this episode. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're located. Welcome to today's Ask a Professional Scrum Trainer webinar. And today we are focusing on the topic of product backlog management. And today we have Todd Miller and Ryan Ripley, two of our professional Scrum trainers. So welcome to you both and welcome audience. And let's get started because I think we're going to get into some great questions here today. Very quickly about scrum.org. We are the home of Scrum. We were founded by Ken Schwaber back in 2009. And our mission is to help people and teams solve complex problems. And we do that through our training, certification, and ongoing learning focused around professional Scrum. We are very big proponents of continuing your learning. We have a lot of free resources on our website, like this session. And we hope that this session plays an important part in your learning journey. So with that, I will hand it over to Todd to introduce himself and then Ryan.
Todd Miller, professional Scrum trainer, almost 8 years now. I can't really believe that, but that's about enough about me. Been around for a bit.
And Ryan?
Hi, I'm Ryan. Thanks for having us. We hope all of you have some great product backlog questions. I think I've been a PST for 6 or 7 years. I'm a little behind. I'm not quite as old as Todd, so, but he gets to be the senior PST on this one. But we're excited to talk with all of you, and we hope you get a lot out of this. And Lindsay, thanks for hosting, and thanks for having us.
Awesome. Okay, so let's get into questions. So this question comes from James. What would your advice be for a new Scrum Master with understanding backlog management?
What do you think, Ryan? You want to go first?
I'll go first. I think for a new Scrum Master, when it comes to thinking about backlog management, I think one of the initial thoughts needs to be partnership. This is something that you're going to partner and teach and mentor and train and work with a product owner on. And so a lot of product owners, they're going to be business analysts initially. They're going to be product managers that may not be familiar with agility. They might have a varying background. They might be really great product people, but they may not have a full understanding of the product backlog. And so what you're initially, like if I'm a new Scrum Master and I'm working with a new team, I'm probably helping to have that. I'm working with that product owner. I'm partnering with them to help them understand that you're creating a transparent vision of the future of the product, that we need a product goal to decompose into product backlog items, that this product backlog will be the key communication tool between you and between the product owner and stakeholders, between the product owner and developers, between all of the conversations around our product, whether it's in sprint planning or sprint review or everywhere in between, is going to be centered on this artifact, this product backlog. So I think initially you're a partner, you're helping build this out, you're teaching and training on great ways to do that, but you're also saying, look, this is a core piece for empiricism. And this is where a lot of good collaboration is gonna happen. What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, I think what's been on my mind recently just around product backlog management. So 100% agree, Ryan. You know, you're in a partnership with your product owner, and one thing you have to be concerned of is and constantly question whether that product backlog is transparent. Just another thing from a tool perspective, because we get a lot of questions about tools, is just because there's a feature in a tool doesn't mean you have to use it. A lot of what we oftentimes see is product backlogs that are over complex because of all the features that tools give us, and the tools box us into how to do product backlog management. So I think that's stressing the transparent product backlog angle with you and your product owner as a Scrum Master, really making sure that that is coming to fruition, and that you're helping as an enabler of that rather than just enabling all the features in a tool because we paid for them. So think that's about it for me. That's just been on my mind. Over complicated product backlogs because of our tools.
Wait, Todd, you don't like 107 required fields on a product backlog item?
Right. Yeah. And that 107 is a small number compared to some of the product backlogs we've seen. So.
All right. Thank you both for that advice there. So this question comes from Marcus. What tips can you share on how to refine a large PBI that is too large to fit within a sprint?
Yeah. So I think that this might be, we were just talking about this yesterday, that decomposing product backlog items is an art form, right? And so the mnemonic that Bill Wake came up with quite some time ago, invest, right? I think still is applicable, depending on how you're doing your forecasting and things like that, the estimable thing. But invest is an mnemonic that Bill Wake came up with. I being independent, N being negotiable, V being valuable, E being estimable, and T being testable. And so that's a mnemonic that you can kind of look at and see, especially dependent. How can you break down that product backlog item into independent pieces that are still deliverable, that still give value to your customer? That mnemonic from Bill Wake's been around for quite some time. I think it really still works. And it's something that you just have to work on. It's not easy to break product backlog items down at first, but once you get it and you get the art form of it, you can't unforget it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to go along with invest, which is a great way to, I mean, you can start challenging your PBIs if they're too big and ask questions about each section of invest. I also think there's a mindset component here, Todd, that, you know, there's a difference between slicing work and breaking it down. Breaking it down assumes that all the components we break down are going to get done. When we're slicing work, I think the mindset you got to take on is like a gold miner. You know, there's a lot of rocks and gravel and dirt that has to be sifted through before we get to the gold, which is what we want. And so when you're slicing work, you're not keeping the rocks and the gravel and the dirt. Like when you're mining, that stuff is discarded. Like, we only want the gold. So you're slicing down to value in an effort to do the minimal but sufficient to meet the needs of that PBI or the problem you're solving. And so I think that mindset shift, along with, you know, Todd's thoughts on the art of breaking down that work through invest, I think those two things together can get you a very long way.
That's great advice there. Thank you. All right. So many questions. Keep them coming. And if you had dropped questions into the chat, if you could please move them over to the Q&A, that would be great. That is the best way to capture all the questions. There was a follow-up question that came in, Ryan, regarding when you were talking about product backlog management being a partnership with the product owner. The person had asked for some clarification on that because they always felt like the product owner was solely responsible for product backlog management. So they want to know a little bit about that partnership.
No, I think, and that's a great follow-up. I think that the product owner is accountable for the product backlog, but that doesn't mean that they're on their own. I think a Scrum Master is certainly accountable to support that product owner as they learn how to manage managing a product backlog, creating product backlog items, ordering them, sizing, hopefully developers are sizing, but taking that sizing into account as we look at, you know, road mapping and all the things that a product owner needs to do with the product backlog. I definitely think the Scrum Master is a partner in that through the training, teaching, and mentoring. I think developers are a partner in that as they size and decompose and refine. You know, product backlog refinement is a team sport, or it can be as well. And so this notion that product owner, you go off and you do the product backlog, and developers, you go over here and do all the code, and Scrum Masters, well, we don't really know what you do, but go and do your thing. That's not going to work in today's world. We are collaboratively working together on all aspects of product delivery, and we are, as a Scrum team, held accountable ultimately to get to done. And so the partnerships and collaborative opportunities are endless in the Scrum framework, and a Scrum Master and product owner are certainly going to be collaborative partners as we build out and refine and improve our product backlogs.
Great clarification there. Thank you, Ryan. Hope that was helpful. So this next question here from Victor, what would your advice be if management doesn't understand the advantages of a single product backlog in a setting when multiple teams are working together?
So multiple teams are working together on the same product. I'll just make that assumption. Well, I think it's, now this is probably a very simplistic example of it, but it's sort of like going to the grocery store with five lists, right? and you don't know which one to choose. So yeah, the thing that comes to my mind too here is the explicit order of a single product backlog. Now there's different product backlog management tactics that you may have to take when you're in a more scaled environment, right? I think levels of decomposition have worked for me in the past in that circumstance, but you're talking about a single ordered list. That means we're choosing to have one thing that is the most valuable. Another aspect of this too, resonating from Scrum Guide 2020, is we now have product goals, right? So product goal being a longer term objective from the Scrum team. And have a single product backlog with product goal with multiple teams working on it means we're getting more done faster, right? So, you know, our good friend Dan always says, stop starting and start finishing. With multiple product backlogs, odds are you're not finishing and there's a lot of work in flight that teams don't know about. Let's get that one single concentrated list. Like we wouldn't go to the grocery store with five different lists and work from there, right? You might need to take some different tactics for product backlog management, but in the end of the day, it's easier to make it transparent. We know what's the most valuable and everybody's on the same page.
Well, and to Todd's last point there, everyone being on the same page, how do I as a product owner effectively work with a stakeholder on discussing roadmaps, future vision, potential things that we could be working on if there's five different lists and we don't have them all, or we're not clear on where the overlaps are. And if we do not have that holistic list, you know, to that last point Todd was making, it becomes very difficult to keep to give a clear, cohesive, accurate message to our stakeholders, to our customers, to our users. And that can certainly lead to a wide array of problems from a stakeholder management perspective as well. So yeah, but I love that analogy, Todd. Can you imagine going to the grocery store, the five lists and all the things that my kids are texting me to get? And by the time you get home, you forgot 10 things and no one's happy. So.
Especially if you go hungry, then you just come back with all kinds of junk food.
Exactly. You have to get hangry at the grocery store.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you for that. So here is a question. How do you prioritize and order the items in your product backlog to ensure maximum value of the product?
I think about what's valuable and I put those things first. And I know that's kind of a silly answer, but it's, you know, as a product owner, I'm continually, you know, Todd has this great quote that he talks about where the product owner, and I think he got this from some, I don't know, he'll attribute it correctly, but the product owner is an opinion aggregator. And I think that might've come from Simon Reindel initially, but Todd has been pushing that really hard in our classes. And I think it's such a beautiful way to state it. You know, we've got all of these ideas, all of these needs, but ultimately the product owner has to sit down and take all of that user feedback, customer feedback, stakeholder feedback, developer feedback, all these different areas and aggregate that down into what is valuable. And when they decide and they come up with this model or this idea or this understanding of what is valuable, then they can actually look at their product backlog and say, what is the minimal but sufficient and the most important things that we must do to achieve our sprint goal and ultimately our product goal, and just be laser focused and absolutely ruthless about doing just those things. And I think if they can get to that point, then that value maximization that's implied in the question or that's asked about in the question becomes possible. But if we're not there, if we don't have those prior steps, then that value maximization and the ordering and sizing and estimation, all that stuff is just, it doesn't help you. And so I think that first step is be that opinion aggregator, get a clear understanding of what value means in your context, and then ruthlessly pursue that value and don't let anything else distract you. And if you can get that part right, I think the rest becomes easy.
Yeah, and you know, just to add, we often talk about there being other factors involved in ordering the product backlog. Maybe if there's dependencies, as Ryan said, size, risk associated with it. I also think about how, and we actually have another webinar coming up in a couple of weeks about how we can relate how we manage a product backlog to evidence-based management. Because we're hopefully our product backlog items are either trying to deliver something that is valuable to our current users or customers, or maybe we're trying to deliver something that may be seen as valuable to new or potential customers. And so I think that depending on where you're trying to go into the market, that EBM could really help guide you with how you want to answer. And so I think that I've been thinking about that quite a bit recently, about how EBM can really make your product backlog more transparent and maybe give you ideas on how to order it, and maybe even have you convinced that you shouldn't be spending as much time in it because everything you're doing is a guess. It's a hypothesis of value. So I think I just said a lot there, but I'm just talking about what my mind is processing.
Well, no, I think you said a lot of good stuff there, Todd. And I think one of the most important things that people should walk away from that, from this whole discussion with, is everything on your product backlog is a guess until you deliver. So if you really want to be a value maximizer, make the smallest bets possible, deliver the smallest things that could possibly work, and get that feedback rapidly so that you can validate that you're actually delivering value to somebody somewhere who's using your product or service. So I think that delivery piece, that rapid delivery, rapid feedback, is often missed as well. It's a great point, Ted.
Awesome. Thank you. That was really great. So this next question here. So what tips do you have for managing stakeholders when communicating the priority of the backlog items and when they can expect outcomes for their area?
Yeah, so usually when we get this question, so just a story. I think my first time being a product owner, I was like 29, right? Working in an area where people had been in a company for a long time. It can be contentious. I think you just really need to be honest about it, be transparent, make your product backlog transparent. That doesn't mean just send them in an Excel, but relate to what they're hoping to learn and hear about it. And one of the things that I find that people are not, we have to remember that not everybody knows or even cares about Scrum, right? One of the things that they do know and care about oftentimes is money. So knowing how much a sprint costs and then potentially relating that to some kind of forecast on what some particular feature, something like that, might cost is really good, powerful information that allows you to have deeper conversations. So when it comes to that, I don't think there's a perfect way to manage stakeholders. Know who they are, maybe categorize how close or how far you need to have them. Make sure they're in your sprint reviews if they are somebody that is actively involved in what you're working on now. And know what a sprint costs, because that, as a product owner, is sometimes the leverage that you need to get people to kind of back off, to be quite frank.
That's great advice there. Thank you, Todd. Do you have anything to add, Ryan?
No, I think Todd covered it. I mean, those are some great tips to go with. I think we're good.
Awesome. All right, moving right along. So many questions. Keep them coming, folks. These are great. So hello, Todd and Ryan. Two questions in this one. Is it worth it to have PBI classifications? If yes, do you have any pattern or suggestions regarding PBI classifications? For example, stories, bugs, improvements, spikes?
So for that question, this is where I start to think a little bit about Kanban, right? So defining work item types. I don't know that I would call them classifications, but work item types. And I think it's worth defining those, because ultimately you want to try to have as many common attributes on your product backlog items as possible, because that creates simplicity in your product backlog. However, for a new feature, I don't think you need reproduction steps like you would a bug, right? So I think it's totally a thing to do to classify what kind of work item types that you have. and then try to find common attributes, and maybe there's more specific attributes that you have under those work item types.
That's great. And Todd recently wrote a blog about product backlog item attributes. I'm going to drop that into the chat.
Thank you, everybody.
You're welcome. All right. So this question here, in your personal view, what is the optimal format for product backlog refinement?
Whichever format that actually, first of all, gets you to do refinement during a sprint. So if you're actually doing refinement, I think that's a win. As far as formats go, I mean, you're asking questions about the PBIs, you're making them smaller, you're ordering, you're refining. Some teams like to have checklists. There's different schools of thought there. I think walking through, Todd brought up Invest from Bill Wake. Like, why not just question, interrogate every PBI according to the, independent, negotiable, valuable, estimatable, small, and testable. If you walk through those on every PBI and they meet those criteria, you've probably done a good job. And then if you're finding that that's not helping you, adapt it a bit. So, I think that for me is a good, and that's what we recommend in the new product backlog, the professional Scrum product backlog management skills courses, walk through Invest as part of refinement, and we have some other methods in there as well. But, I think that could be just a great way to get started, and it's a low impact, easy way to get going. What do you think there, Todd?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I don't really have too much else to add, I don't think.
You know what? Let me hop back in there. The format question, we see this in every Scrum event and in a lot of practices. Everyone wants to know, should we do a Harry Potter retrospective or a Star Wars? Or would a Star Trek be better? And personally, I prefer The Hobbit. But, whatever you pick. But the substance of it often gets missed. And reviews get totally neglected. But in this case, with the refinement, asking for format is great, but are you actually doing refinement? Because the bottom line is, it happens whether you like it or not. It's going to happen haphazardly during sprint planning, or it's going to happen in a controlled and planned way throughout your sprint. And I think that's something to look at. Format's important, but how we execute it and when we make time for it and whether or not we're consistent with it, I think ought to be primary levels of concern as well.
Great, thank you. All right, this question, Alan here is looking for some advice, it seems, on what he should be doing. So, hi guys, we lost our product owner, so the business analyst took over PO responsibilities, then lost our BA, and they were replaced with a junior BA. So I found myself taking on a lot of the backlog management as a Scrum Master. Should I be scared? Are we the Titanic heading for the iceberg? Apologies if this question's a little too specific.
Yeah. Thanks for the specific question, Alan. So you're not the Titanic. Everything's okay. This makes me think of several times that I've been a Scrum Master for a product owner that had never been a product owner before. It does worry me a little bit with the junior comment, just because the product owner really needs decision-making authority. And so I would really make sure that your organization is respecting the fact that that person is going to be making decisions about the product, value-based decisions. But I don't view this very much different than when I was a Scrum Master for a person that didn't even know what a product owner was, but they were anointed a product owner, whether from the business or from IT, and they didn't know. This is why you're busy as a Scrum Master and why you get a paycheck, right? Because you are going to have to step up. You are going to have to help them. You're going to have to teach them. You may be having to do some of the stuff and show them while you're doing it. And hopefully over time, you can make sure that they are growing in their ability to be accountable for value maximization. But I guess I'm just thinking back to the times where I was in those circumstances, and it's not an overnight transition. It's really, you may find yourself doing some PO stuff, but make sure you're not just doing it and you're explaining it to the product owner and with the notion that eventually they'll take it over.
That's great advice there, Todd. Anything to add, Ryan?
I would just add in, I love everything Todd said there. It's so important to work with these people, and the junior tag is kind of concerning, and I would look into all of those things and take care of that first. I also think it's really important to go find the person whose budget you're spending and get them involved. There's always a product owner. Like, there's never a situation where you don't have one. You may just have not followed the money far enough yet, right? There's always someone's budget you're spending, and get a hold of them and say, hey, we've got the seventh person in 2 weeks has stepped in to tell us what to build. It's your money. Would you like to be the product owner here and help us out? Because it's your cash we're burning. And I think that following the money in that situation could also help get that authority granted that Todd was talking about, can help you connect with people in the business who understand the product and the needs a little better. And I think it can do a lot of good things for a team, because at some point, the person whose budget you're spending will show up to a review and want to know what they've gotten for all that money that's been burned.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Alan, for this question. I hope this helps. So this question here. So how do you balance immediate business needs against long-term goals in the backlog? Oh, Todd, you're muted.
Yeah, evidence-based management. So the word goals in here is interesting. Immediate business needs against long-term goals in the product backlog. Mm-hmm. So Scrum now since 2020 has two different goals horizons. You have a sprint goal, which is 30 days or less. This is the commitment we're hoping to accomplish. Then you have a product goal, which is a longer-term commitment of the Scrum team. This is not in the Scrum guide. This is, I would say, like a Toddism. My feeling about it is that product goal shouldn't be more than 3 to 6 months. Even 3 months is really long. But what you have to weigh is, if there's business objectives outside the realms of your goals, what's going on? Right? Is it really important work to do? That should be things that the product owner is consistently questioning. Is it something that can wait? Because anything that you do that's not related to your goals is a distraction against your goals. And so the thing that I like that EBM adds into addition, EBM has three different levels of goals, right? You have strategic, which is a really longer term objective, years often. You have an intermediate goal, which you could potentially correlate to the product goal. It's a near term objective. And then you have immediate tactical goals, which you could, if you wanted to, correlate to a sprint goal. And so the three different tiers of goals allows you the opportunity to ask yourself a question: is this related to our active goals? Very similar to a team that gets asked to put something new into their sprint backlog. Is this going to impact our ability to achieve the sprint goal, or is it related to the sprint goal? You do the same thing as you put things in your product backlog as it relates to the product goal. And then hopefully maybe you're checking out EBM and relating those product goals to your strategic goal. Anything else is a distraction in focus, and I would question whether it's valid or not.
Awesome. Thank you. Anything to add, Ryan?
No, I think EBM is a great way to address that question and need. So totally agree with Todd.
Great. All right. So this next question here from Ben: how do you handle constantly failing PBI estimations?
I'm not so worried about estimates being right or wrong. And I'm not really worried about actual versus estimated. I think estimated versus actual is one of the worst metrics you can look at. I don't care if we're good estimators. I care if we're good at delivery. And so what I'm looking at is, are we achieving our sprint goal each and every sprint? Not whether or not we could plan the perfect sprint at the beginning of the sprint. And I think that's such an important distinction. The sprint goal represents value. If we're achieving that sprint goal each and every sprint, we should be maximizing and achieving value through that delivery of an increment. Stop worrying about these scoreboard metrics. If you're delivering and hitting your sprint goals, delighting your customers, and getting that rapid feedback, you're winning. And that's what I would focus on. I just don't think trying to become the best estimators in the world lends itself to becoming great at product delivery. I think those two things are separate.
makes sense. And, you know, it's interesting. And this could be controversial, but in a lot of instances, SME is a waste of time. Why are you doing here? What I want to get to is the core of it. Why are you estimating? What are you trying to get out of it? What's the purpose of why you're estimating? You know, I think that there's other things that we can use to bring into sprint planning to be a little bit smarter about capacity than just estimating things. And so I started thinking about that as it relates to EBM recently. And I almost see, I see estimating taking time away from, like you were saying, Ryan, delivery. So why are we estimating that? Like, let's start asking that question, right? Why are we estimating? What value are we getting out of estimating? I know there's cases where you have to be able to forecast. You have to be able to forecast maybe go to jail items, right? Like compliancy stuff, but what else are we looking for? Are we looking to get certainty around delivery with that? Because I think that the time that you're certain is when you're done, it's shipped, it's in the user hands, and you're measuring the validity of it. That's where certainty is. And even past that, we're still not certain whether it was going to work or not. So I've been kind of questioning a lot of that in my brain a lot recently, rather than push it off and say you shouldn't be estimating at all, what I'd like everybody to do is start questioning why. Why are we estimating? Let's figure that out first, and then let's go from there. In a lot of instances, it's just because someone somewhere is craving complete certainty when we're coping with complexity.
You know, Todd, something else to add there, to link it back to a previous question. And of course, I agree with you that they're craving this certainty in a complex world. But if teams would spend as much time studying, practicing, and worrying about slicing as they do estimation, I believe the problem would take care of itself. If you're good at slicing, the estimates really aren't so relevant. You can look at cycle time, throughput, item aging, all really good time to market measurements within EBM and the flow metrics. And if you get good at slicing, perhaps the estimates just become less and less important.
That's great. And there are quite a few questions in here about slicing and breaking down items. So can you both share some of your favorite techniques for that?
So I like looking, so maybe I'm an old school nerd. I like looking at the database and seeing logically how data is sorted, and then seeing if there's ways to break down features or PBIs based off of data patterns or areas of concern in the database. I think that's one good way to look at it. I think workflows are another great place that I tend, my brain will drift there as well. If there's, you know, some sequence in a process or practice, that might be a good place to look for areas to break down. And I think those can initially be helpful, but ultimately what we're trying to do is get a good slice of a holistic feature. And again, to Todd's point, that's an art, you know, so you can look at data patterns, you can look at the workflow of a story or of a feature of a PBI, but ultimately, we're mining for that slice of goodness that can tell us whether or not this hypothesis, this PBI, is actually valuable. I mean, those are my two. Todd, you got some favorites that you like?
I just think there's different ways to look at a PBI and break it down. I think that very popular is user story mapping. I think that you can even do impact mapping to give you some idea on how you can get a path to a very particular user. I think it's really important to know who your users are, because you may have a product backlog that just says something is targeted towards a very specific user. Yeah, I see a chat too. Henry put the spider in there, which is cool. I think that's like my cone thing, which works really well. But we need to understand our users, because you might be targeting a really a general user base when you actually need to target a particular one. And I always think of the example, and I don't know where I saw it, but I think of why you would book a hotel room. So there's a difference between, so a person booking a hotel room, right? That's one thing. But there is a difference between saying a father bringing kids to a hotel room that I want to book versus a business person that wants to book, right? So very knowing who your user base is and maybe categorizing some of your demographics so that you can specifically target functionality tends to take that genericism away from the user stories or product backlog items or job stories or HD, whatever you're using, and can make you specifically target things. That's also valid for experiments. If you're looking at unrealized value or current value, a specific user that you're trying to get, or maybe a specific user that you already have, you're trying to build upon. So yeah, all those, I think that we've just named a whole bunch of them. Experiment with them, find what will work for you today, but that is of no guarantee to work for you tomorrow, unfortunately.
You know, let's pull on that thread for just a quick second, right? I love the hotel booking example. So you've got people who walk up without a reservation and try to book. You have people with reservations who try to book. You have frequent travelers like Todd and I used to be with a billion points who try to show up and use points. You have people who show up and expect a free upgrade. You could probably, if we worked at it, list off 100 different scenarios for booking. And now as a product owner, you've got to pick which one makes the most sense to do first, which one could be the quickest to get out and get an experiment on. And you're weighing all of these different decisions and different types of users. You're looking for biggest bang for the buck, but you're also looking for what we ship quickly. And so all those considerations come in. I think, Todd, that's a wonderful example. And if people really pulled that thread of it, you'd start to see the type of user that might be a really great place to start, just because of, even in a generic application, if I log in and I'm a user, my experience is going to be very different than an admin. And so maybe that's a little too basic, but it's a good place to start thinking about ways to slice down and work through that. So I love that example.
Great. Thank you. All right. Hope that was helpful there. And there's a bunch of content on scrum.org blog as well regarding slicing. This question comes from Greg. He just dropped it in the chat. We want to help our product management folks give broad estimates and timeframes to upper management, though we know that our own estimations are only really useful for a current sprint. Is there a good way to represent and measure past delivery other than playing with velocity calculations?
Yeah. What did you deliver to production, and are customers satisfied with it? I think we need to move away, Ryan. I think you used a term like vanity metrics, right? Like, so this is what we were kind of talking about before. So upper management wants that. What's upper management want that for? What indicator is that giving them? Because we're maybe losing an opportunity to have a new conversation around what metrics we actually care about, what we should care about. And to me, delivering stuff to your customers that they use and that they like with high quality in a timely manner is important. And you could have increasing velocity over the course of 8 sprints and have not delivered anything, right? You could have everybody 100% utilized and at capacity, and your customers are leaving you in the droves. So I really like to kind of try to turn that conversation and say, and get with those managers and say, what information are they looking for? And let's have a better conversation with them rather than around these vanity things like whether we estimated it correctly, what's happening with story points and velocity. Because at the end of the day, all that stuff could look really good, and your delivery engine is not delivering anything, it's failing, right? So I think we really need to start moving away from some of these things. And I think there's really good answers. There's things that we can use. I keep saying EBM because that is a great way to back into new, better conversations, right? Is through the discussions of goals and measurements and the key value areas of EBM. What do you think, Ryan?
Oh, you know, I totally agree. I think EBM changes the conversation. And I think teams, check it out. There's a ton of great information at scrum.org/EBM. Todd and I have EBM related materials on our YouTube channel. All sorts of great stuff out there. Actually, our new EBM book in the scrum.org series, I think will be out in a couple of weeks here. Lots of great materials coming up. But I also think, plus, just to put a big plus sign after EBM, if you're working with these executives, a trick I used to do is I would take a big printout of like the Doppler radar map, and I would just lay some PBIs on the map and say, look, we're forecasting, these are the goals, or these are the things we're trying to achieve now. These are the things that could be next. Here's the things that could be later. And just put in the context of the Doppler radar, because this is a forecast, right? We're really, and I think Todd made this point very well earlier, we're trying to move away from this discussion of complexity, or this discussion of certainty in a complex world. We're trying to more like weather forecasters rather than perfect estimators. We want people to understand, here's what we believe is true today. The weather pattern might shift, new data might come in, a new opportunity might emerge, and the second that happens, we'll update you. But everything we're talking about is subject to change, because the world's complex and wild, and opportunities emerge, and if you don't strike when the iron's hot, you miss it. And I think that's the kind of conversations we need to have, instead of, well, my team can do 12 story points every sprint. I think the first conversation, the one that Todd is provoking with EBM, is a lot richer than these story points, which are really just not really meaningful outside of a Scrum team. Let's make that shift. Let's get it. EBM on top of a product backlog, I think, is the killer combo that's going to emerge over the next few years here.
That's great. Thank you. And we did get a couple comments here in the chat. Thank you for bearing with us, everybody. Ryan had a last minute change in schedule, and that's why he's doing this from the car, and hopefully the audio is okay. And I just wanted to recognize that. So apologies for that. So moving right along. So judging by the fact that refinement can be a team effort, how can we engage the team in generating more insights to perform the refinement itself?
So interesting is make sure that the right people were there. So we see this pattern where during refinement, there's this issue of consensus and this constant consensus thing that comes up. Consensus doesn't have to mean every single person is involved in it. And so I've oftentimes gone to refinement sessions where you see 10 people sitting in a room with 3 people talking. Make refinement, and maybe you have a regular schedule for refinement, and just decide last second who should be there, who could go, what potentially are we talking about? So I think that might be an interesting thing to consider, making sure that the right people were there and putting the onus back on to the team to do it. And maybe it doesn't have to be on a schedule. Maybe it's just something where the product owner earmarks some things that need to be refined during a sprint, and the team does it just in time. So
that's great. Thank you. Ryan, anything to add there?
No, I think that's great. I like it.
Awesome. All right. So this is an interesting question. How can we efficiently manage a backlog that mostly consists in recurrent activities?
So I'm going to make an assumption on this one. I'm going to say the recurring activities are bugs. And if that's not the right context, I apologize. So this pattern comes up regularly. We get the same 20 things that pop up each and every sprint. We're always firefighting and triaging, and they come in to our backlog and over and over and over. So proper product backlog management, I think, would dictate that we get to the root source of these things that are recurring and stop them. Actually create product backlog items that stop those things from recurring. And I think that's the step that a lot of teams, an extra step that teams won't take. And so I think that's really up to a product owner to say, look, I know these things keep coming in over and over and over. Like, how can we invest in such a way that these things stop coming in, so that we can look at better, newer, more valuable opportunities instead of the same old things? And so I think that could be one way to tackle this question without a lot of context. But if it's some kind of other situation, definitely happy for a follow-up. What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, you got my head on bugs. And so here's the situation, and the way that I feel with bugs is, and I'm not sure where I got this advice. I got this advice, and it was really, really good advice to somebody that somebody gave me. I wish I knew who to attribute it to. So thank you if you're out there, or whoever's out there that gave me this. is, as a product owner, do not get into a position where you're managing bugs, where you're a bug manager. Deal with the bugs, order them at the top, get rid of them. Bugs happen. We're dealing with complex work. There's no reason to punish anybody for anything around that. You want to know how many bugs you have, but do not become a bug manager. That's a waste of your time, right? So order your bugs at the top and get rid of them. And so, Ryan, you might have locked me in there in the bug conversation, but product owners should not be bug managers. And so whoever gave me that advice, it was really awesome early on when I had first become a product owner. And I've always thought about that ever since.
I think that's a t-shirt time. Manage product backlog.
Yeah. Don't be a bug manager.
There you go. Don't be a bug manager. That feels like a conference talk. We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, hopefully that helps some of the other questions that came in regarding bugs. So this next question from Steven here. As a PO, I've noticed for myself and read on forums that the backlog can become quite extensive. Where and when do I make a cutoff and close items we will not get around to, or should I just ignore the list becoming longer and longer?
You should. Yeah. The second you know that you're not, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
Oh, go ahead.
The second you know that you're not going to do that work, delete it. And not a moment later, right? The delete key is a product owner's best friend when it comes to product backlog management. And quite honestly, if you're executing Scrum well, if you're having great sprint reviews, and you're working with your stakeholders and your users and your customers together the latest, greatest information, you're talking about the markets, the usage of the product, the budgets, the opportunities, the competitors, and you're getting all that new information and you're adding new PBIs to your product backlog during sprint review, because honestly, sprint review is really just it's a fancy way to do product backlog refinement. So you're getting new information. But that's happening. So many new ideas are coming in each and every sprint that your ideas on the product backlog that are already 3, 6, 8 months old, you're never going to get to them. And they're just stressing you out because now you have to maintain them because they're inventory instead of opportunities. And so I say, be ruthless, set a line. If something's older than, and start conservative. If a PBI is older than 6 months, it's gone. And you know what? If you accidentally cut a good idea or two, they will come back. Good ideas are like boomerangs. A customer will fling it right back at you the second it reemerges, and not a lot is lost. If we don't do this, if we ignore the growing backlog, it turns into that ending scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that endless warehouse of artifacts, and it's anxiety provoking. I see a product backlog with 1,000 items on it. I don't even know what you're trying to build. I can't understand where we're going. As a developer, you've put me on a treadmill. This is essential. The delete key is essential. Set a line, start deleting. Good ideas will come back. You'll be all right. What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, Ryan took all my punchlines.
Awesome.
There were a lot of great punchlines in there.
So. Here's two things just to reiterate what Ryan said. Set a limit on product backlog items. It doesn't have to be the date, but say no more than 50 items in the product backlog. If you have 49 and you want to add a 50th, or if you have 50 and you want to add a 51st, delete one. If it was good, it'll come back.
Yeah, you know, people treat these PBIs like they're their children. And it's almost like it's just, when you say delete, people get panicky. I say be ruthless. Look, something we talked about in the backlog management class is how ruthless Steve Jobs was with the first version of the iPhone. Todd, do you think Steve Jobs had 1,000 items on his backlog for the first iPhone?
I don't know. I don't think he used a backlog.
Right. Maybe, but I think there were some very key things that were important, and everything else was negotiable or deletable. And I think that's the mindset we got to get into. Just this ruthless execution of product management and the idea that we are going to do the minimal but sufficient. I love that mark you set, Todd, of 50 items. Let's see if people can get there. That maybe it's the 50 PBI challenge. That's another t-shirt.
That was great. Lots of t-shirts in that answer. So that was awesome. I hope that helped. So this next question here, how do you challenge product backlog items that seem to be quick wins but introduce more technical debt?
Well, I think you need to know your technical debt landscape for that. And also, this is a point in product this is a point in product kind of decision. So what I mean by that, I was a product owner for a product that was only capable for English. And there was a market opportunity if we added additional languages to it, which seems simple on the surface, but when it comes to how different countries other than the US use metric rather than empirical and the number formatting, it actually was a really complex thing to implement. And there was a good way for us to do it, and there was a down and dirty way for us to do it. But we wanted to see if we could capitalize on the market. So we down and dirtied it and just jammed it in with 5 different languages, knowing that we would have to go back and revisit it. But we wanted to test the validity of us getting in these other markets. And it was successful. And so knowing that it was successful and wanting us to expand to over 20 different languages, we went back in and we cleaned it up to be able to be capable for that. So I think it really comes down to what's happening with your product and if it's a point in time thing, because we consciously inherited technical debt to prove that we could be successful in that market. And we were successful in that market, so we fixed the technical debt. The thing is, we fixed it. We didn't just let it sit there. We didn't build upon it. We fixed it once we validated it. So I really think it depends on the point in your market, but make sure you're earmarking that as stuff that you need to go back and fix. You've just deliberately chosen to take technical debt on, and you have to pay it back. So yeah, that's all I got.
Awesome. All right. So we have time for maybe one or two more questions here. We got a couple of follow-up questions in that I thought were interesting. Going back to the recurring activities where we kind of drilled in on bugs, someone asked what if the product is customer relationship management software and part of the recurring activities are things like creating email campaigns?
That seems like an activity that you're going to do. So if you're doing CRM, right, and part of it is, and if email is an activity, then something that you could look at is automation. You know, as a product owner, if there's 10 steps to getting that email built, could I use Zapier or some other tool to automate 5 of them away so that an email template with pre-fed information is available and I'm reducing the time spent? I think that's a good investment by a product owner. Sometimes there's just cost of doing business. There are things that Todd and I have to do to run our training company that I wish I could automate away, but I can't. And, you know, invoicing would be one of those topics. And, you know, sometimes there's just activities that are going to recur each and every sprint. But I think the mindset here is challenge the assumptions. Do I have to do this email work? If I have to do this email work, can I automate it? If I can't automate it, why can't I? Are there investments I can make to free up this time? And I think if you continue down that path of questioning and not giving up after the first objection or two, I still think you can make some good headway, even for these repeatable activities that seem to be mandatory, but can often be reduced, perhaps not to zero, but perhaps to something smaller.
That's great. Thank you. And we have one more follow-up on the question about the product backlog getting too long and deleting items. So this question here, what should you do if you have a higher up to the Scrum team, like a VP, that will not allow the PO to delete items? And there was another question similar to that as well.
Yeah, I saw a couple of those drop. What's interesting is this sounds to me like a PO that is not empowered to be a product owner. It sounds like the VP really is the one making product decisions here. And so if the VP is not allowing a product owner to actually be a product owner, this, I think, in turn becomes a Scrum Master problem, right? So you've got to meet with that VP and you've got to work with that VP on why it's important to empower a product owner to be a product owner. So again, Scrum Masters, this is where you earn your paycheck. What's a Scrum Master do all day? Deal with this kind of stuff. And ultimately, if a product owner isn't allowed to delete something off of their own product backlog, I can't think of a more miserable situation for me, right? Where I'm trying to be ruthless. I'm trying to keep that list small. I'm trying to understand it so that I can answer questions to it on the spot with really tough to deal with stakeholders. I'm trying to make it transparent. I'm trying to describe why I've ordered it the way that I've ordered it. The last thing I need is someone telling me that I can't delete something that isn't going to be done for 10 years or if ever, or that I don't find any value in. It just seems like an unempowered product owner problem. And so I think Scrum Master's got to get to work on this one.
That's great.
You know, something I used to do in this situation, and I'm sure Todd's heard me tell this story a billion times. So here's a billion and one for Todd, but I would just sit outside the VP's office every day. So this is me as a Scrum Master. I'd visit the VP every day with the product owner and say, hey, this is what we intend to do. Do you approve of it? And after the first 3 days, it's cute. After 2 or 3 weeks, the VP's annoyed. And then we kind of earn that right to have that conversation about empowerment. And I think that's one of the things a great Scrum Master, that's back to the partnership and collaboration discussion. You know, a Scrum Master is a partner to that product owner. That they're trying to get that product owner almost promoted to that level to where they have authority. And we will not tolerate anything less. And so we are pushing and striving to get that. Sometimes you got to walk through the big door and go talk to the VP, as Todd mentioned, or visit them every day and get their opinion until they tell you, hey, I'm too busy and we agree. So let's empower this person. Let's get rolling. And but we don't give up. Like Scrum Masters, you've got to keep that conversation going all the time and make sure that we are getting that product owner the empowerment and respect and authority needed to be effective in their role.
Yeah, that is super important. All right. So thank you both so much. You've shared some really great answers here and advice. We are running up on our time, unfortunately, but I will be sharing these questions with Ryan and Todd, and we will figure out a way to address them in some format. Thank you so much to our audience for your great questions. There were some really, really good questions that came in. I'm just going to close this out here with a few quick items. So we do have a new product backlog management course here at scrum.org. Todd and Ryan both teach it. This quote here is from a student of theirs. So please feel free to check that out for more learnings about product backlog management. And we also have free learning paths on our website and lots of content. So please feel free to check those out. And be sure to check out Ryan and Todd's YouTube channel as well, Agile for Humans. And they always are putting out some great content there. Todd and Ryan, do you have any final words you want to leave with the audience?
Thank you. Thanks for having us. This is always fun. And Todd, always enjoy bouncing this stuff off of you. And Lindsay, thanks for putting up with our nonsense.
Oh, yeah, check out our EBM book coming out in the Scrum.org series in a week.
Yep. Yes, that is coming out very soon. You'll be seeing lots coming out from scrum.org about that as well. So thank you, everybody, and Scrum on.